Just learned that Dave there at Premier Radio Coast to Coast in the control room is a Vegas guy, Las Vegas guy. I'll tell you, we're everywhere. We're taking over the world. And our guest tonight, Richard Dolan, was here a week ago. Richard, this is just for speculation. If you don't want to answer it, you don't have to. But Joe Biden during the presidential campaign, he was commenting, and it got him in a lot of trouble. He says, that President Obama, if he were elected, would be tested. Would there be some kind of a crisis? He'd be tested early in his administration. This would fit the bill, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes, it would. Whether he's talking about the UFO secret, my suspicion is that he wouldn't, just because he's talking in such a public manner about that.
Right.
I mean, there's all kinds of tests that are here. We've got the financial crisis that I think comes immediately to mind. Hey, before I forget, I really want to make sure that I mention this, because sometimes when I talk about disclosure, which I strongly believe in, I make it sound like it's never going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Nevertheless, I really think that people should do what they can to promote this. And one thing that they can do very practically is visit the website factsonwashington.org. And this is run by my friend Stephen Bassett, which is a national, I mean, he's really trying to get a national movement here for people to contact President-elect Barack Obama, write a letter to him to ask for disclosure on the UFO topic. Factsonwashington.org. I think it's an important idea, and I think we should all do what we can to participate. And just whether it happens or not, it's important to make a statement like that.
And I think probably now, whether he does it or not, now is probably a good time to give it a try.
Yes, absolutely. He's fresh. He's going in. Whether he's been briefed or not, I think he very well could have been briefed even by now. And if not, I think he will probably be briefed to some extent in the near future. So I think Barack Obama is a very, very astute man. He was an excellent campaigner. He's shown that he's got a lot of capability there. He's now going to be dealing with something that he may never have really considered up until now.
And, as a perceived outsider, and maybe he's not really an outsider, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, but as a perceived outsider, he has some advantages in this regard, in that he wouldn't necessarily be saddled with the baggage of explaining all those years of lies.
Right. He personally would not. The only thing that comes to counter that in my mind is that he's now the representative of that elite. It's not that he can just act on his own as some kind of cowboy, but it is true. I mean, he may... Who knows? There are large institutional powers at work, but people can still act on their own. And it's very possible that Barack Obama could surprise us.
I want to talk about the paper trail and how you got into this topic. I know that for me as a journalist, for you as an historian, that's the kind of evidence that we can grab and hold in our hands.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
You know, this stuff about abductions or lights in the sky, it's here one minute, it's gone the next. It's hard to document that stuff. I'm not a big, deep cosmic thinker or anything about the implications of all this, but a paper trail, a document, a witness, something that's written down, I can follow, and that's how sort of how you got into this, right?
Yes, we really, both of us, got into this in a very similar manner. I was doing a doctorate in history at the University of Rochester, Cold War studies, basically focusing on the Truman administration circa 1950. Nothing to do with flying saucers, I can assure you. Privately, I became interested. In fact, I was walking in a bookstore with my wife, and I saw a copy of Tim Good's Above Top Secret. I think it was in the early 90s, and I thought,
right.
Wow, that's a neat-looking title, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up, the subtitle. I remember flipping through it and recognizing many of the names that he had in there, but all in a UFO cover-up context. And then there were all of these alleged documents. They looked real. I thought, are they real? I wanted to know. And so my question wasn't even, were UFOs real at that point? I wanted to know, were they a legitimate part of our history? And if they were, why had I never read about it in any academic history book? Even if it was a mistake, if you've got a bunch of 3-4-star generals or CIA directors who are possibly taking this seriously, is that not interesting? Should that not be part of our history? And yet, it seemed to me at the formal academic level, it was always getting blown off. So I just started on my own private little research project to look into it and find out for myself what I thought, and that just sucked me in. That was 15 years ago, and I have not left the field.
Yeah, you're a goner. You're a
no,
goner now.
Oh, completely. I'm just so. But it's been a great experience. And what happened is that in the beginning, I'm sure like with you, I was almost maniacally conservative about this. I didn't want to deal with the crazy parts, the abductions or the crop circles or mutilations and anything that just smacked of, you know, fringy beliefs. I just thought, I don't want to deal with that. I want to deal with, is there a phenomenon that our military has encountered? And that was a good starting point, certainly. But the problem with that is simply, if you stay in this field long enough, you realize just how bizarre it is. And it would be analogous to like going to the beach, you know, going to the Pacific beach, and you get up to your ankles, and you think, well, that's enough. I don't want to go anymore. There's a huge ocean out there, and you stay in it long enough, and eventually you're going to have to start swimming.
Well, and you, you know, it's not only that UFOs, this whole question exists as an interesting little side note. I mean, your thesis that you sort of develop it in UFOs and the national security state is that this has helped to shape who we are, how our government works in a much broader scale than just an oddity on the side.
That's right, George. Thank you for pointing this out. I didn't really just try to write a UFO history. What I tried to do was a little more ambitious, and it's to rewrite American and indeed world history with the UFO phenomenon sort of mainstreamed into it. Now, admittedly, you can't do this completely without enough data, and some of this has to be made by inference. But if you assume that the UFO phenomenon is a big deal to our leadership, and it certainly looks like it, then you have to assume it makes a large covert footprint on our history. After all, what would the, you know, what's the true history of, say, the Kennedy administration or the Nixon administration in relationship when you consider UFOs? And these are the types of issues that I tried to work in to my history. And again, I've tried to do this in the next volume, UFOs and the National Security State. The subtitle of that, by the way, is The Cover-Up Exposed, 1973 to 1991. The reason I call it The Cover-Up Exposed, incidentally, the first subtitle was Chronology of a Cover-Up, now The Cover-Up Exposed, because during the 1970s and 80s, again and again and again, one dynamite revelation after another came out, blowing open the old cover-up. What happened, however, was that there was a counterattack, as it were, on behalf of secrecy. Counterintelligence efforts, I think, succeeded in working their way into the UFO field and to some extent, disabled those revelations.
Okay, I got to stop you there because that's a great point to tease the audience when we come back, because that was the one thing that you told me about when we had our recent conversation here in Las Vegas, how the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, actually maybe has contributed to the creation of disinformation. And we'll get into that topic as soon as we come back with our guest, Richard Dolan, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. My guest is Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State, and soon to be a sequel. Richard, here in Las Vegas, you said something really interesting, and that was that the Freedom of Information Act, which has been a boon to you and to in your research and to other historians and journalists, may actually have contributed to the creation of what we know as disinformation in the UFO field. Explain.
Yeah, I've wondered about this. What I think happened is that in the late 1970s, let's rewind the clock and pretend that we're back in, say, 1976, 77, 78. There are two very, very critically important developments in UFO research, at that time. One was the Freedom of Information Act, which FOIA had originally been passed back in the 1960s, but it didn't really have the teeth necessary to do UFO research until the mid-1970s. 1974, it got re-energized, and people were now allowed to make public inquiries into the government on all kinds of issues, including UFOs. By the late 70s, these efforts started to kick in. So what happened is, where like the FBI or the CIA for years and years would say, we don't do UFOs, it's not our interest, it's beyond our... Suddenly, that lie was revealed, and we've got thousands of pages of documents on UFOs from those agencies, from all the military agencies, Air Force Intelligence, Defense Intelligence Agency, and so on. Now, among those documents, there wasn't a single smoking gun, like no one document that was like the memo from the president that says, oh, my God, what do we do about these aliens? Okay, but at least not confirmed. But there were many documents that were one cut below that described incredible encounters by our military with what can only be described as UFOs. doing impossible things. So that was one thing. Now, the other threat to secrecy was, as I mentioned earlier in this interview, the leaks that began to occur from the inside to various researchers, leaks dealing with crash retrievals of UFOs, most famously Roswell. When Stanton Friedman, for example, was down in Louisiana, met up with Jesse Marcel Sr. almost by accident, by chance, that came out. But there were many other stories, too. Many of them were leaked to the researcher Leonard Stringfield, who at that time collected a large number of insider testimony, sort of like the earliest whistleblower-type testimony that we now hear a lot about these days. But back then, it was a new thing. So you've got these two prongs of attack, so to speak, on the old secrecy. If you're one of the secret keepers, or if you're in the intelligence community, maybe monitoring this problem, this could be difficult. So what do you do about it? Well, there is evidence showing, in my view, that starting in the late 70s, early 80s in particular, initiatives went out to disable those Freedom of Information Act documents and the crash retrieval leaks. I think this is possible. Are the MJ-12 documents such an attempt to do this? It's a hard question for me to answer because I think there's a lot of evidence showing that those MJ-12 documents have validity to them. After all, there is data in those documents that seems to be very accurate, that's very arcane, for example, the mentioning of Donald Menzel in the Majestic 12 documents seemed almost like a joke to researchers originally, because Menzel was such a hardcore debunker for years and years. It caused researcher Stanton Friedman to go to the Menzel archives at Harvard University, and what Stanton there found was that Menzel had lived a double life, and he had a very high level of clearance within the intelligence community, was an expert cryptographer, and was top level connected into NSA and so on. And so that Menzel would have been a very good person to be on the MJ-12 committee. There was a lot of other arcane knowledge about those documents in terms of the dates that were listed in there that give one pause before you just throw them out as debunked as hoaxes.
So suggesting that at a minimum somebody on the inside created these documents, if in fact that they're just disinformation.
Well, what I think may happen is that these documents were leaked. Some of them are legitimate. Some could be hoaxes. Since the original documents leaked out, there's an enormous amount that have come out, and some appear to be hoaxes. Some appear to be legitimate, in my opinion. But if you've got these legitimate documents and you leak them in such a manner that they are disputed, that's like getting an inoculation for a disease that your body then learns to reject. In other words, you package the truth in such a way that it becomes not believable. And I think that the leaked documents in this manner fit that bill. There's another thing the intelligence community did that is very clearly, I think, disinformation at this time, and that's its relationship with the National Enquirer. The National Enquirer, I look at straightforward as a CIA publication through and through. It was run by a man named Gene Pope for many years. Now, Gene Pope was CIA. He was also actually came out of the world of organized crime, but he went with CIA in the 1950s and then founded the Enquirer. What did he do with this publication? The Enquirer in the 1960s and 70s and through the 80s published some very legitimate UFO stories. This was the thing. It's fascinating. Bob Pratt was a journalist. He did a lot of good work there.
Yeah.
The problem was there were some very demonstrably false articles on UFOs in the Enquirer at the same time. And then, of course, packaged in such a sensationalist tabloid that nobody in the academic or scientific world would ever look at the Enquirer. A lot of true information came out in the Enquirer that also we were sort of, that the scientific community was inoculated against. The 1975 airspace violations, for example, were first revealed in the National Enquirer. They were all true.
Yeah.
But because they were in the Enquirer, no one followed up. And this is how I'm looking at the leaked documents. Those MJ-12 documents in the early 80s came out through certainly what appears to be Kirtland Air Force Base. And Special Agent Richard Doty of the Air Force seems to be very closely connected with these documents. And all of this seems to be part of an intelligence operation, the full story of which we still do not know because they're not talking. But we do know that a year and a half before the MJ-12 documents were shown, were sent anonymously to some researchers, that Richard Doty showed researcher Linda Moulton Howe documents that were very, very similar to the MJ-12 documents, but also kind of different. The MJ-12 documents in late 84 did not discuss a crash in Aztec, New Mexico. They only mentioned Roswell and then another crash in Texas, whereas these other documents shown to Linda Howe did describe not just the Roswell crash, but also this crash in Aztec, New Mexico. Why the discrepancy? Why? Well, could it be that that some of these documents were not exactly true and others were true?
Is disinformation sort of one of the focuses of the second volume of your book?
Yeah, it is. It is, absolutely. I dealt also with the famous case, the Paul Benowitz case, where Paul Benowitz, he was a private defense contractor, scientist, who lived right outside Kirtland Air Force Base, outside Manzano weapons range there. And in the late 70s, early 80s, was seeing some very bizarre activity over that range. Now, it has been argued by some researchers that what he was seeing was fairly conventional, exotic, yes, but cutting-edge, but conventional types of U.S. weapons being tested there. And the argument had been made by others that all the UFO stories were fed to Benowitz, the rumors about a base at Dulce, New Mexico, and all of this was supposedly fed to him to take him off the path of what was actually going on. I don't believe that. What I believe happened is that, yes, Benowitz was messed with by the intelligence community. Absolutely he was, because he was seeing genuine UFO anomalous activity over by that base, and he had to be dealt with. And I will make that argument. I have made that argument. When the book comes out, you'll be able to read about it.
Rick Doty, by the way, had his involvement in the Benowitz story. And, of course, Benowitz, it was kind of a tragic story. He sort of went around the bend.
It was very sad. And
I should point out to our listeners that I have invited Rick Doty to appear on this program a couple of times. He's agreed to do it. And we're just waiting for the right date.
Oh, I think that's great. He's a very interesting man. I've had some correspondence with him myself. And there are people who look at Rick Doty as this evil guy because he's messed with the UFO field. I don't really know how I feel about all of that. I mean, this is a man who's doing his job. Okay, the first thing you've got to say is that he was in the military and he did his job. And whatever you think about that job, whether you think it was right or wrong, I think, one has to recognize that he wasn't acting as some lone guy out there. He was doing something that he was supposed to be doing, that his supervisors wanted him to do.
Yeah, which makes you wonder who the bosses were and what the marching orders were.
We have to keep this all in mind. And I don't fault individuals in the intelligence community who are doing their job. Everyone's got to make a living. but also there are people like ourselves who want to research this and figure out what's happening, and we also have a right to find out, too.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to talk to Richard Dolan about Area 51, Bob Lazar, Phil Corso, and a heck of a lot more. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State, about UFOs, cover-ups, disinformation, things of that sort. We know that scientists in general, mainstream scientists, don't want to touch this topic with a 10-foot photon torpedo because of what it might do to their careers. I wonder if the same is true for historians. Richard Dolan is an historian, and I wonder if he's paid a price for coming out so strongly on this very strange and interesting topic. We'll get into that as soon as we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Thanks for staying with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest is Richard Dolan. We're covering the gamut of UFO cover-up and secrecy topics, including disinformation. Richard, I want to ask you the question that I alluded to in that tease during the break there about what this has done to your career. Now, can you write about this stuff? Although you're writing it in a scholarly way, the same kind of standards you would do if you're writing a biography of Harry Truman or something like that. You're crossing the T's, you're dotting the I's, great research, but what happens to you in historical circles, in historian circles, I should say? Do they look at you like you're crazy?
Well, yeah, I left the formal world of academia when I dived into the UFO research field. And for about a year, almost 2 years, when I was doing dissertation, PhD work, at the last couple of years of that, I was doing UFO research too. And the thing was, I couldn't bring you couldn't bring UFO data into the university setting like that. It would be the most career-ending kind of move. It's hard to describe. The mindset within the formal academic world, it's one of mortal terror of having to deal with a UFO topic, unless you were to deal with it as a cultural phenomenon and to, in a sense, disable it and
Or make
take it
fun of it,
seriously.
yeah.
Right. But if you were actually to believe this, then it is a career killer. The only academician who's a tenured professor who's teaching this on a regular basis anywhere in the country, I believe, is Dr. David Jacobs over at Temple University. And he has spoken many times about how it's hurt him. Now, for me, there are very few professional historians who will talk to me. There are some, though. And in fact, I will get emails and phone calls from a number of tenured professional historians who really admire my work. They tell me this. One
Off
gentleman
the record, though.
who was off the record always,
Yeah.
one was a department chair at UCLA, not in history, but another department over there, and whispered into the phone. He was literally whispering into the phone saying, "I really like your work. I think you're great. I had a sighting myself once." And I said, "Well, I appreciate that, but why are you whispering?" And he said, "Oh, I didn't even realize." But he said, "You have to understand, my department is so political. I mean, I got enough problems as it is. If they knew that I was interested in this problem, it would kill me."
But here you are. You're the same guy. You're the same guy who's written papers on other historical issues and personalities. You've done the same kinds of research. You have the same meticulous standards. You approach this topic in the same way, and yet you're chastised for it.
Well, I do. Right. You can only do what you believe in. I'm the kind of person, I've always been like this. I was 10 years old. I was the same way. My mother will tell you this. She said, "You've always known who you are." And my dad was a retired, now he's a retired New York City cop. And I grew up with my father telling me when I was a little kid that you can be a minority of one. And if you have truth, if you believe in what you do, you've got to be willing to fight for it. And I'll tell you, I took it to heart. I've always been this way. I've always had my own mind. And when I got the UFO bug, so to speak, I could not let go of this. I had to pursue it. And if it meant not getting a tenured teaching position at some university, which is what it did mean, then so be it. I look back sometimes with a little bit of chagrin over that decision. Life could have been easier for me had I gone a different route, but it would have been a lot less interesting. And I can tell you, I have no regrets, none. Over the
Well,
road and gone.
my line to that would be, can I get an amen? Because I know right where you're coming from. By the way, I want to mention something earlier, Richard. You had mentioned this fax on Washington. If
Oh, yeah.
people are interested in sending a message to the government that urges disclosure, a couple of folks have got the email address wrong. It's not a fax, FACTS. It's fax, like you'd send a fax, FAX.
Yes.
So it's faxonwashington.org. That's Stephen Bassett's website. And also on the Coast to Coast website, you'll find Richard Dolan's site, keyholepublishing.com, if you want to get some information about Volume 2 when the book comes out. When is it coming out?
Springtime. I'm thinking, in fact, if assuming Stephen Bassett has the X conference, he has it every year. If that goes on in April as planned, my book will be available for purchase at that time. It's in the home stretch right now, and I'm just going over some final polishing here and there. We've got to index it. We've got to do a couple of things, get it out to the printer, but I think it will be ready by the springtime.
Of course, one of the focuses is, as we have been discussing, is disinformation. Is there still a disinformation effort underway, or did they've successfully planted those seeds, and now academia and media and things like that don't take it seriously without any extra prodding?
It's possible. Yeah, I think that disinformation doesn't go away. I think that the most significant measure of control, pardon me, I think occurs through the academic and media channels. And I think this is what keeps the topic safe for the time being. But I wonder, there are all kinds of stories that have surfaced in the last couple of years. There's the Serpo story that was all the rage a couple of years ago, and I know you're very familiar with this as well. One has to wonder, this certainly smacks of disinformation, in my opinion, the story being that there was a human-alien astronaut exchange, essentially, where it was some of our people went over to the alien world, lived there, came back, and so on. And that whole series of essays, the Serpo essays, were really very well written. I mean, they were interesting to read. They were really, it was a fascinating story, but I think it had all of the qualities that one would expect from good disinformation.
I remember being told by some people that I know fairly well who were in a position to know that there was a seed, a kernel of truth to that story, but of course then it was just turned into something else. And I also remember when the Serpo revelations were coming out, and one every couple of days, that somewhere right in the middle of that stuff, and you were probably on that mailing list as well, somebody sent out a survey. They sent out a survey form that basically asked, hey, by the way, are you buying this? It struck me as pretty clear that that was some kind of a disinformation program.
But right. I mean, and the point of disinformation is not that it simply lies. I mean, that's too simple. So for anything to be believed, there's got to be something that's credible to people in the know. And this is the thing about the Majestic documents. Since you just got me on this train of thought, I want to point this out. I was chatting earlier today with Stanton Friedman about Majestic 12 documents, and of course, as you know, he believes that the original small batch of MJ-12 documents are legitimate. He doesn't believe that the majority of the subsequent documents released are legitimate. I'm not so sure, and I brought this up with him, but here's the thing. When you stack up all of those documents, right, and these are available on the website of Dr. Bob and Ryan Wood, and I don't have their website off the top of my head, but you can search it. But when you print them and stack them, it's about 2 inches or more thick. We're talking about a lot of documents here. And so if those, and they look real, they have the feel of a real document, in my opinion, and they all deal with detailed, you know, nuances of the UFO and alien reality here. So if they are hoaxes, if they're fake, they are disinformation of the highest order. And you have to ask yourself, are they complete fabrications, making these stories up out of whole cloth? Who would they be designed to fool? I mean, us? Me? You?
The Russians?
The Russians, maybe. Now, if they're designed against the Russians, that makes it interesting, because you have to assume the Russians wouldn't buy any of this ET stuff unless they had reason to think that it was true, unless they had their own encounters with ETs.
Well, we only need about 2 hours to talk about that, Rich. You and I can have a conversation about that as well. One of the stories near and dear to my heart, of course, is Area 51, Bob Lazar, all that stuff. And, you know, a lot of the UFO hierarchy is completely dismissed it for whatever reason. You're one of the few who doesn't. Doesn't mean you endorse it, but you have it as is still in the open basket, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, whenever I hear you, George, talk about Bob Lazar's story, I always find myself thinking that this perspective, your perspective, is really the one that I'm personally closest to of other people who are out there. And let me just make my own position fairly clear here. I have not met with Bob Lazar, and I've met a couple of people who've had interactions with him and who know him pretty well. I don't know Bob Lazar, so let me just get that straight. But I've read most of his transcripts, all of his interviews that he gave over the years. I mean, I'm very familiar with what he has said. And it strikes me that his statements are totally consistent. He has not changed anything significant that I am aware of, nor have I ever gotten the idea that Bob Lazar really tried to capitalize on his fame. Other than he made one video, it's true, on his knowledge of Area 51, but it's not like he's really done any follow-up on this or really done anything to promote himself. On the contrary, I get the sense about this man that he's a very low-key individual, he's kind of a geek in his in his temperament. He's very intellectual. He strikes me as someone who went to S4, which is what he has said. I have spoken to individuals who on the private have said to me that their intelligence sources tell them that yes, indeed, Bob Lazar was at S4. Now, whether he saw all of the things that he has claimed to see, that is, flying saucers, basically, and the briefings that he says he read, that may be a different story. I tend to find credibility there. Now, there are other issues. It's true. His education, his claimed education at MIT, there's no evidence that this was true at all. What's going on with that? I don't know. I don't know the stories. I don't know the full story, let's say, of what is this enigma of a man. But I do know, George, that you and a number of other journalists have cultivated contacts with inside Groom Lake. And I know that you, for example, you said that you've interviewed about a dozen or so insiders who have corroborated large parts of what Bob Lazar says, right? But just none of these people want to go public.
That's true. It's actually more than two dozen now. I think Bob's story was never going to be confirmed or proven or disproven one way or another. It's going to always be a question mark for folks. I do know this, is that as we're discussing disinformation, he's been dismissed by a lot of people because, well, we think that he was just trying to distract attention away from something else that was going on at Area 51. And if that were the case, someone should have their butt kicked because it was a miserable failure. Because as a result of Bob's stories, there are people, for it's been 19 years now, there are people out in the desert watching for whatever is flying around at Groom Lake. There's been incredible scrutiny, congressional scrutiny, media scrutiny. So if they wanted to distract attention away from whatever's going on there, it was a miserable failure.
No, it's been absolutely heightened. Another person that a journalist, and I think really did some important work on this, was James Goodall, who did a lot of writing for Jane's Defense Weekly, Aviation Weekly, Space Technology, and a number of other very highly reputable publications. And I know that in the mid-1980s and into the early 90s, he also was interviewing a number of Groom Lake insiders who told him that, yes, absolutely, positively, UFOs exist, better than Star Trek. One person said to him, we have things out there that are better than Star Trek or anything you can see in the movies.
That would make George Lucas drool.
Exactly. So now, none of these would constitute proof. We understand that. But when you get responsible journalists cultivating sources, you have to understand these people are not just going to give their names out. They can't do that. They're violating security oaths, or they're putting themselves at risk in some way. So, this is what it looks like. It looks like there is some very advanced stuff. And the story comes down to the fact that not only then have we retrieved exotic alien technology, but we've been trying to replicate it. And of course we would. I mean, you wouldn't expect the powers that be simply to sit on this stuff and look at it. Wow, what a nice flying saucer. They're going to try to figure out how to make it work with our science and with our materials. And so this is a very logical thing you'd expect. And indeed, these are the leaks that have been coming out for over two decades.
We're talking about disinformation and misinformation. It always is amazing to me that how easily it goes over. That you mentioned earlier this report that came out from the ex-FBI guy about cattle mutilations.
Oh,
and it was
poor
research, but media, scientists will latch on to anything that makes it easier to explain this stuff away, and they don't give nearly the kind of scrutiny to the flimsy explanation as they do to the original topic.
No, it's true, and it's sad. I mean, people, we like to think that we've really got it all together, but we're pretty simple creatures when you get right down to it. Even the scientists and the academicians, they all got a job to do. They all go home. They all have dinner. They all hang out with their family. How much effort do these people really want to put into investigating something that is going to change their worldview? I mean, go back any period of human history. Just throw a dart on the map of the human history, and whatever era you land on, you're going to know that people have held beliefs that were wrong. And not just regular folks, but brilliant folks. They have all kinds of wrong beliefs. So the question that I often ask myself is, how many new revelations about your worldview is any person really willing to take in their lifetime? I think there's a limit to what a lot of people can handle. Not everyone's the same, and admittedly, but I think that in general, Once someone hits adulthood, they like to think that they've got it all figured out, and they end up spending the rest of their lives filling the blanks of what they think they know. So when you get to be 50 and you're some responsible scientist, and the last thing that you want is for some outsider of your field to blow your paradigm to pieces, and then, you know, you've realized that you've spent your whole life missing the boat on this big, big thing. I mean, who wants to come to that? So I think psychologically, there's a very strong disposition for people not to question the big picture. You know, once that's been put together, I think they want to just stay with that. There are always exceptions.
Well,
absolutely. But in general, we're up against entrenched psychology here.
Well, as also in our discussion of disclosure, and you know, you and I are both on the same page. You know, the First Amendment is sort of my religion. I would be in favor of freedom of information and disclosure and things of that sort. And then you have to ask the question, disclosure of what? Because we don't know what the ultimate truth is, the big picture of this story is. And, you know, I guess it is remotely possible that it could cause significant disruptions of society depending on what the truth is.
Yeah. I think it will. In the short term, I think it will cause a lot of disruption. That's not a reason to avoid it, though.
Right.
Now, if you're pulling the strings and if you're in charge of that society, that it may be a good reason, in your opinion, to hold back. For the rest of us, I think, I mean, my argument for a long time now has been that the cover-up of the UFO phenomenon, it's easy to see why it could have started for legitimate reasons. If you're trying to figure this all out in the 1940s, you may want to have time to decide, you know, how serious is this? And we need to keep this away from the Soviets. We don't want them to get the technology, and so on and so on. But the problem is that the secrecy on this has a corrosive effect, I believe, on our political system. And so that it has forced the creation of extra-constitutional means of maintaining that secret so that members of Congress, by and large, are cut out of the process. The American public is cut out of the process. This is an important thing. It's gone on for 60 years without our informed consent as to what's actually happening. Now, at a certain point, you've got to ask yourself, where do you draw the line? Okay, there is legitimate need for secrecy at times, but for 60 years? How long are we supposed to go here? This is very certainly the largest single issue, once it comes out, that would affect our lives in so many ways. It would transform our world, and there's a balance here, and the balance, I think, now has to come down on the side of the public's right to know what goes on. This is supposed to be a republic. It's supposed to be a democracy. That means the people are supposed to rule, and the people can't rule if they don't have sufficient knowledge about their world.
Well put, Richard Dolan. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to open up the phone lines for your questions for Richard Dolan, author of UFOs and the National Security State. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM.